This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area Monday, March 11th, 2013. iNews reports that during the 12-year span between the mass shootings at Columbine High School and the Century Aurora 16 theaters, Coloradans used guns to kill themselves about four times more frequently than they used them to kill each other. In the wake of the Aurora attack that left 12 people dead and more than 50 injured, lawmakers this year introduced numerous gun control proposals that have sparked contentious debate. But the iNews analysis found that of the 6,258 gun deaths in the state between 2000 and 2011, 76% were suicides, while homicides comprised 20%. The rest were either accidental, legal shootings by law enforcement officers, or unexplained. Gun suicides in the state were disproportionately committed by white residents, while homicide victims were disproportionately and predominantly minority residents. Colorado was below the national average in gun homicides, but above the national average in gun suicides. I recently heard that there has been a run on certain kinds of ammunition. Apparently, at some stores, people line up two or three mornings a week to buy ammunition when they open, following a delivery the night before. Last Friday, I went to one of the two largest sports stores in Grand Junction and stood in line with about 100 people waiting to buy ammunition. Some of them were willing to talk when I asked them why they were there.
Self-preservation, it's real simple, especially in a rural community like this. Law enforcement is not going to respond if someone tries to invade your home. They're going to come take a report, they'll investigate, they'll prosecute, but they're not going to protect you. As far as the debate about whether or not we should have guns, we need to look only at the war on drugs to... I mean, that's a perfect example of how you can outlaw anything. It doesn't mean it's not going to be here. There will always be a market for it, and there are far too many guns and weapons already out there, here and all over the world, to eliminate them and keep them out of the hands of the criminals. Bottom line is the only thing that is going to protect you from a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
My government's buying up 1.6 billion rounds of ammunition, light armored tanks. They're arming themselves for some sort of civilian war, so I'm going to arm myself accordingly.
I was reading an article in the paper the other day about how ridiculous gun fear has become in this country when they're expelling five-year-old children from using their hand as a gun resemblance, and just the fact that they're even talking about guns gets them kicked out of school, which is, and that's sort of the hysteria that's going on now with regard to these massacres that have gone on. Nobody likes that, but they're just doing crazy things to prevent people from having guns.
The Patriot Act, I mean, that's a farce. Our Attorney General, I mean, he's a joke. Obama, Imperial Obama. I mean, so if you want something, you better get it now.
So you think there's going to come a time when this stuff won't be around?
The economy's going down the tubes. You don't know what's going on. They're repositioning the military. Who knows? I don't know. They're buying ammunition by the billions of rounds and Health and Human Services. Now, what do they need it for?
Did you say Health and Human Services is buying rounds?
IRS. I mean, what are we going to do? Stop paying taxes and they're going to come and get us? What? I'm nervous.
When the doors opened, I watched a determined but orderly procession of people make their selections. The store limits the amount of ammunition each customer can buy. If the box holds 100 shells or less, you can buy three of each kind. Bulk packages, only one per customer of each kind. Within 15 minutes, the shelves were largely bare of several kinds of ammo. The most popular was probably the .223 caliber, the kind of cartridge used in many of the semi-automatic rifles that some lawmakers want to ban. The same cartridge is also used in the M16 automatic rifle, which cannot currently be sold to the public. The Colorado Supreme Court heard arguments on an historic education funding case Thursday. Parents in several school districts sued the state for failing to offer a uniform and thorough education system and not putting enough money into schools. A lower court agreed with the plaintiffs, and now a final decision rests with the state's highest court. A decision is still months away, but here, Benta Berkland takes a closer look at the case as part of our Capital Conversation series.
I'm here with Joe Hannell with the Durango Herald and Tim Hoover with the Denver Post. We were all at the state Supreme Court and heard the oral arguments. Joe, this is a historic case. What's at stake here?
What's at stake is maybe up to $4 billion a year extra that the state would have to spend on schools. That gets close to doubling what they spend right now. This case started out at the beginning part of the last decade in the San Luis Valley, where the roofs were coming down on the kids inside the schools, and they sued and said the state's not providing a thorough and uniform education as the Constitution requires. It's worked its way through the courts a few times now. This was its second trip to the Supreme Court. The first case was basically just whether they could proceed and whether the courts could get involved with this. The court said yes. Plaintiffs won in their trial in 2011, and now we're back here at the Supreme Court.
And so, Tim, Joe touched on the argument from plaintiffs, which is we're not having a uniform education system. It's not adequately funded. The state comes forward with new mandates and rules and benchmarks, but doesn't give the money for schools to be able to do that. What's the state's case?
Yeah, the state's argument is basically we're already spending 40%+ of the general fund on education. And on top of that, even though there may be some disparities in how districts succeed, Colorado students on the whole perform much better than students nationally, despite per pupil funding numbers being lower. So their argument is, hey, money alone doesn't necessarily help. And essentially they're saying, like, look, this is a separation of powers issue. The courts can't tell lawmakers what the right amount of money is that should be spent. That's the state's argument.
However, Tim, as we know, the state already lost the argument that the courts don't have any business getting involved in this. The Supreme Court said in 2009, oh, yes, we will be involved in this. And for the past 4 years, the Attorney General's office has continued to argue an argument that's already lost. The justices at the oral arguments were trying to see to what degree they should get involved, because there's no question that they will be deciding whether Colorado's school finance system is constitutional or not. And the Attorney General's office just doesn't even want them to decide that question in the first place.
And briefly, I just want to touch on the makeup of the court and what you guys thought of the arguments. We had one Supreme Court justice that had to recuse herself from this case, so there were six justices hearing these arguments.
Supreme Court Justice Monica Marquez, prior to being appointed in 2010, she had served as a Deputy Attorney General under John Southers and actually had helped work on the defense, the state's defense in the Lobato case. So what that leaves then are six justices. And there's some people who think there could be a 3-3 split on the court in a decision. Now, if that happens, they don't bring in a tie breaker. All that happens is the lower court ruling stands. So that would mean the district court ruling stands and it gets kicked back to the legislature and they're essentially told, fix it.
Joe, when there's Tabor and they can't just raise taxes themselves, how do they come up with this money if the plaintiffs win?
Well, that is why this is such an interesting question, because nobody really knows. It's kind of uncharted territory for Colorado. There could be all kinds of different things that could happen. Legislators could decide to ask voters for a tax increase. They could just kind of continue with a bit more of what they've been doing and squeeze some other programs to try to get a bit more funding for schools. I think the plaintiffs would say that wouldn't fly. This could cause a legal case against the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights. This could say this constitutional provision actually doesn't work with the rest of the Constitution. We have to either suspend or get rid of Tabor and just give the legislature the power in this one case to raise taxes on its own. There are all kinds of things that could go on, and chances are kindergartners today will probably be in high school by about the time this is finally all settled.
Thanks. That was Joe Hannell, a reporter for the Durango Herald, and Tim Hoover with the Denver Post. I'm Benta Berkland, and this is Capital Conversation.
The Denver Post and the Associated Press report that a Colorado mortgage banking company, co-owned by former U.S. Senator Bill Armstrong, is one of the latest businesses to file a lawsuit challenging a federal mandate for employer-provided health insurance to cover contraception. The lawsuit was filed Tuesday by Cherry Creek Mortgage Company, which does business in 27 states and has 730 employees. The lawsuit says the requirement violates the rights of evangelical Christians who object to being forced to provide insurance coverage for abortion-inducing drugs and devices. According to the Post, Colorado Christian University, where Armstrong serves as president, also filed a lawsuit challenging the contraception mandate as a violation of deeply held religious beliefs. Last week on I See Change, Marilyn saw daffodils and hyacinths peek out. Lindsay enjoyed mint growing by Orvis Hot Springs. Noah spotted a bee, and Pat reported that her first calf was born. Andrea Lakos noted that elm, juniper, and maple are already at strong medium pollen levels, and that measurable pollen started showing up as early as mid-February. Last year's allergy season saw pollen counts at a record-breaking high. Andrea wonders if scientists are predicting another high pollen year and thus another bad year for people with allergies. The answer is yes. Quote, climate change will increase pollen production considerably in the near future, says Dr. Leonard Bielary, a specialist in disease management. In fact, according to research presented by Bielary last fall at the annual scientific meeting of the American College of Allergy, Asthma, boy, this is a long one, excuse me, the annual scientific meeting of the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, plant-based allergens are expected to nearly double by the year 2040. Bielary's findings rely on pollen counts calculated as the average number of pollen particles in a cubic yard of air over the course of a day. He found that counts in the northeastern U.S. averaged about 8,455 in 2000. Through research that mimics predicted climate change, Bielary forecasts pollen counts that will surpass 11,000 by 2020 and will top 18,000 by 2040, possibly pushing as high as 21,735. Not only are the average pollen counts likely to increase dramatically, but the allergy season is also set to start and reach peak levels much earlier in the year. And the warm season is not simply shifting its dates, but in most of North America, it is expanding by starting earlier and ending later, bringing more pollen for its duration. Sorry, Andrea. Keep the tissues handy. It's the new normal. You can be part of the conversation. Be a part of Two-Way Radio at thealmanac.org or kvnf.org. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.